Welcome back. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Jeans and ExtremeJeans.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And you know we're always looking to dig up the stories for you to inspire you to go out and find yours. And one of those stories is now made historic in a book. Written by Kevin Miller, my next guest. It's called Heart of Steel. It's based on a true story. And Kevin, we want to know the real story here, because this is just phenomenal. Now, you were an Air Force guy, right?
Yeah, Fisher. I spent 8 years in the Air Force serving my country. Those were great years. I had a good time. And then I woke up one morning and learned that my name isn't actually Miller. You know, we thought our name was Miller, and learned that it wasn't. What happened was my uncle was at a funeral, and he got some newspapers that he then passed to us that detailed a scandal and a murder back in the 1920s. And my grandfather had changed our name from Puchalski, very Polish name. We had no idea. My father had no idea that that wasn't our name. So we kind of learned it through that newspaper article, and we were having an identity crisis.
So the name was changed to Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
To Miller, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's a big change.
That's a huge change, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why, because my grandfather took all this to the grave. He didn't share that information. He didn't share a lot of information. And we believe because of the scandal and stuff that was involved, he was just trying to protect his family.
Did you know him? When did he pass away?
Yeah, I knew my grandfather very well. He passed away in 1986.
Okay.
I was very close with him, and he was a good man. I didn't know him as well as I thought I did, though.
Isn't that the way it is? You notice that?
Yeah.
Everybody's got their secrets.
He was an incredible man. I mean, they lived in a big farm in Southington, Ohio.
Okay.
And one night, my great-grandfather was murdered in his sleep. And he was 12 years old, and my frantic great-grandmother sent him to get the sheriff, and a big scandal unfolded, and my grandfather and his four siblings found themselves in an orphanage in 1920.
All right, wait a minute. Let's break this down a little bit at a time.
Sure.
Your great-grandfather is found murdered in his bed? Is that right?
In his bed. He was murdered in his sleep. He was shot in the temple while he slept.
Wow.
There was a big story, and this is where the newspaper articles come in, because the Warren Tribune, the newspaper at the time, chronicled this story over the course of about a week and a half. So the story just kind of keeps adding more stuff to it, and there's so much detail in there that it's intriguing. You know, it's incredible.
So today, of course, the assumption is probably somebody close to him did it. And so it kind of starts from there until the next of kin are kind of taken out of the picture. Then they start to look for other people who knew him, people who didn't know him. What was the order of things as they kind of tried to solve this case in the press?
Yeah, the order of it, I mean, initially what the story was, and try not to give too much away, give too many spoilers away for the book, but what happened was my great-grandmother was tied and gagged, and then she sent my grandfather to get the sheriff. Well, when they came, she claims there was three men that pulled up in the middle of the night, tied her up, held her at gunpoint, and then stole $600, some accounts say $500, from the farm, and then took off with it. And then they shot my great-grandfather, you know, after they stole the money.
Wow.
That was the story that she shared with the sheriff and the law enforcement of the day. So they started investigating this thing and breaking it down and finding different clues. And the story starts to take a little twist here and there, and some revelations happen, and a scandal breaks out. And that's how my grandfather finds himself and his siblings stuck in an orphanage in 1920.
Wow. So mom's out of the picture now.
Yeah, they're on their own. They find themselves on their own. And the orphanage that they're in is 1920. That's not a really good place to be.
This is like the Shirley Temple orphanage, right? You know, where everybody's mean and they just tell them everything to do.
Right. Yeah.
You
have to. I mean, yeah, they were very strict. You know, as a Catholic, they had nuns and stuff there in the day.
Boy.
And you know, and it was a very strict orphanage. So my grandfather decided at 12 years old, he's running away with the intent that he's going to go find a job and come back and and take his siblings out of the orphanage and take care of them. And that's part of what,
wow,
that's part of what impresses me about my grandfather so much at such a young age, because he hopped a train and he made it to Chicago. He didn't know where he was going, but he ended up in Chicago. He found a job in a steel mill as a bar catcher. He lied about his age, I'm sure. He was 12, 13.
Got to do what you got to do, right?
Yeah, and then he kind of gets taken in by a couple there, and he kind of finds his way into bootlegging, you know, just running liquor. It's the 1920s, and he makes enough money to go back and get his siblings out of the orphanage and takes care of them.
Now, wait a minute. Now, how does he do that? Because when he left, he's only 12, and I'm sure when he goes back, why didn't they just take him back into custody?
Well, he kind of avoided all that. I mean, he kind of did it on the down low. He didn't, he snuck them out. I mean, he was able to communicate with his siblings. You know, he called the orphanage and he was able to kind of arrange a method of getting them out of the, pulling them out of the orphanage and just stealing them away.
Wow.
So, yeah. And a lot of this, I mean, in the book, I mean, I have the book as historical fiction based on a true story, because I talk about all the stuff I know for a fact, and then I fill in the areas that I don't know, that I have to, in order to pull the story together and to get it the flow and make it a good story.
And I've done that, and you're absolutely right. You know, you have to kind of interpolate what they may have said to each other, what their motivation may have been. And, you know, a lot of books are written that way. A lot of historical novels, you know, they tell you the real story, but they fill in the gaps. And I don't find anything illegitimate about that at all.
Yeah, because it's like I know this event happened, but how did it happen?
Sure.
You know,
and
find all facts about it that I can, and then give my interpretation or use my own imagination to figure out how this must have happened. Put myself in my grandfather's shoes and in his mind, basically, and trying to live that and trying to imagine, you know, what he must have been going through at such a young age.
Incredible.
He was the patriarch of our family, and everybody, all his siblings, everybody always looked to him. You know, he was that strong person that, you know, everybody, I know my great uncle Frank, his younger brother, when my grandfather passed, he just said, you know, I don't even want to live anymore, and his family's not here.
Oh.
You know, it's just, you know, that's how much they loved him and adored him. And he was just that strong man that never complained. He died of cancer, and he never complained. I got to, when I was in the Air Force, I flew up to Wright-Patterson for a class, so he flew me up to the cabin there. I visited with him. I had no idea he had cancer because he never complained. He would never complain about it, and it wasn't too much longer after that he passed away.
So you said at the beginning that it was at his funeral that you got these old yellowed newspaper clippings. Who handed those out to you?
It wasn't actually at Granddad's funeral. It was another funeral of another relative, but it was some cousins. It was cousins of ours, cousins of my dad and my uncle's, second cousins of mine, who had come up to my uncle and said, hey, you might want to read these articles. Because they had been doing some research, a little bit of genealogy, and trying to track, you know, their family, and the person they had working on it discovered these newspaper articles, handed them to my uncle, who then passed them on to us.
Oh, wow.
At the time, he didn't tell us what our name was. We're like, Uncle Rick, what's our name? You know, we're having identity crisis.
So we don't know who we are. Were these then online articles that had been pulled out, or were these actual original articles that had been saved?
These were original articles and copies. I took a visit back to Warren, Ohio a few weeks ago with my dad, who's 86, and my brother, to just try to see what else we could dig up. And we went to the library, and we were able to pull out even more newspaper articles related and printed them out, you know, so I've got more of that stuff there. And also I wanted to find the farm, you know, because I asked my dad, I said, hey, describe the farm to me, because I need to describe, and he couldn't. But what he did is he handed me a stack of documents that he didn't know, realize what all was in there, I don't think. And the documents, in the documents, they auctioned off the farm and everything on it, you know, I guess to help pay for the orphanage and everything else that was going on. So I had an inventory, which gave me a good description of the farm. But we didn't know the exact location. So we went to the Trumbull County recorder's office to find the deed. I found the deed. It didn't have an address, but it has a legal description. And So it wasn't until I got back from Ohio, I was working with a historian at the Warren Historical Society, great lady named Cindy, just, you know, awesome lady. She was so intrigued by the story. She says, we normally charge $18 an hour to do this. I'm doing this for free.
Yeah.
Just because I'm so interested in this story. And she sent me a plat map from 1899, because I knew the lot number was 43 off of the deed that I found, and the legal description in the plat map matched to a T. So I was Perfect. Able to identify exactly the 98.5 acre farm. So it was a huge farm.
Yeah. Yeah. And is it still there? Is it still farmland or is it all developed now?
It's still there. And I plan on taking another trip back there because I want to go knock on some doors over there on the property, because there's like several houses on that property now, and just maybe hand them a book and say, hey, you know, I'll give you a book if you let me walk the property and take some video. And by the way, here's some history on this property that you're living on.
Yeah. I mean, what a story, right? Yeah. By the way, you're in a house where my great-grandfather was murdered.
Was murdered. Exactly.
You know, I mean, that'll get somebody's attention, especially at this time of year, you know?
Oh, gosh, yes. Absolutely.
Hey, I'm talking to Kevin Miller. He's from Burbank, California. He's written an incredible book called Heart of Steel, and it's the story of his grandfather's incredible life, a secret life after the murder of his father. And we're going to continue with more here with Kevin and how he dug up some of this and some of the adventures he's had with it when we return in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back at it on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And as you know, we love sharing the stories with you, things people find out about their families, how they unveiled some of these things, how you can uncover some stories about your family as well. And today I'm talking to Kevin Miller. He's from Burbank, California. He's the author of a book called Heart of Steel, and it's all about his grandfather and his amazing journey going back to a murder back in 1920. And I know you kind of shoved me aside on that in the beginning here, Kevin, but I'm thinking for it to be a scandal, somebody in the family had to have done this, right?
Yeah, you would be right to say that, Fisher. Yeah, that's kind of where it's going. My great-grandfather, he was the good old boy in Southington, Ohio. And he drank a lot, and he was very abusive. He beat my great-grandmother repeatedly. She lost six children.
She lost six children to this because of this?
Six pregnancies, yeah, were lost because of his beatings. He was a very violent, very cruel person. And then he started beating my great-aunt, Dorothy. Once he started beating the daughter, then that's kind of where the murder takes place.
That was it for great-grandma. She'd had enough.
Yep, she had enough. She probably was thinking, whatever you do to me, you do to me. But when you're touching my child, that's where you cross the line. So she took care of it.
Wow. Okay. She did it personally?
The actual story is that she conspired with a brother-in-law who actually took the money that she said was stolen.
Oh, wow.
And they they showed up on the farm in the middle of the night drunk. The first night they'd gotten lost, so they're kind of bumbling a little bit.
So they got a lot. They're not really good at this. Fortunately, they're not real experienced. Okay.
They weren't good at it. And the next day, she signaled them with a flashlight. They came in, and actually, Frank Oliasiski, who's charged with the murder, as well as my great-grandmother, his hand was shaking. And she actually had to steady his hand for him to pull this off.
Oh, my gosh. What a story. Yeah. So let's get into some of the details, because you've obviously done tremendous research on this story, and you've written it as a historic novel, which I think is just great, because as we talked about in the first segment, that's kind of how you fill in some of the gaps that you're just never going to know. What were the conversations? Right. What were the relationships? Things like that you can kind of fill in. So do you have the court files from all this?
I do. I have quite a bit of documentation, a bunch of documents that my dad had and he passed over to me. There is documentation that details the trial of my great-grandmother, the trial of Frank Oliasiski. I have all the pleas. They originally charged both of them with first-degree murder. then they pled it down. Ole Osiski went to prison for 20 years for second-degree murder. My great-grandmother went to prison for manslaughter. She got, I think, 5 to 10 years, and she served 3.
And so this is why your grandfather and his siblings all wound up in the orphanage. Was there ever a reunion?
Yes, they did. Once my great-grandmother had gotten out of prison, she was with her sister in Lisbon, and they did. They reunited. That's all detailed in the book,
Wow. The
reunion.
Now, this is tough because I want to talk about your grandfather now. He was just a kid. How old was he, 12?
He was 12 going on 13. So
okay.
He was just a young kid, and it's like, you know, I'm trying to imagine putting myself in his head and thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, my mother is gone and my father is dead.
Yeah.
And my siblings are in this horrible place.
Yeah, but he's getting into bootlegging in Chicago during the gangster era of the 20s.
Right.
Wow.
Right, because he's looking to make as much money as he can with the idea and the purpose of going back and stealing his siblings out of that orphanage and taking care of them himself.
That's incredible. But did he come through this period of his life? That's a very impressionable age, obviously, going into your teens. Was he able to walk away from it ultimately once he'd achieved his goal?
You know, it definitely had an effect on him, because later on, I mean, he started to kind of go down that same road as he got a little bit older. And as the story moves on, he goes to Canton after he's left his siblings with his mother. He meets my grandmother, who's a fiery Irish woman, and he actually buys a bar, a speakeasy bar, with the idea to take care of his new fiance. And,
right.
You know, and
he knows
and so
the business, after all.
Yeah, he kind of goes down the road a little bit of his dad with the whiskey and such, and my grandmother kind of pulls him out of that and kind of saves him. So the last part of the book is their love story, and my wife says that's her favorite part. She loved the whole book. She goes, that's my favorite part, though, the love story. It was great between your grandparents.
Because it's obvious that he really was the patriarch of your family and the one that everybody looked up to, and he would do anything for them, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was that sort of person. Everybody looked to him for things. And my great uncle, Frank, when my granddad passed away, Frank's like, you know, I don't even want to live anymore. What's the purpose of living now without Stan? Because they just looked to him for everything, you know. So
he was the guy.
Yeah. I've got a lot of information and a lot of background information on a website I actually created for this called heartofsteelbook.com. There's more stories and more information up there.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, of course, for people who listen to this show, they're either just getting started in genealogy, maybe they're more established, but it's always interesting to hear what kind of records you found, how you went out to gather these stories. And obviously, there were people who knew a few things. Is there anybody left who, once they found out that you knew, spilled their guts about some of these times?
Yes, there was some. Now, because my dad's cousins, the daughter of my Aunt Dorothy, who was the oldest of the children who was abused, she sent him a letter, actually, and I actually got some good information, because he handed me the letter that she had handwritten to him, because she seemed to know a lot about this story from her mother. And I pulled a lot of stuff out of there. A lot of the stories of the incidences of her being abused, you know, are in the book, and I pulled them from a letter. So they're actual incidences that really did occur. So I learned a lot from that based on the story. And just talking to other relatives that, you know, somebody knew a little bit, this cousin would know a little bit about that, and, you know, and the children of my great uncle Frank, my granddad's younger brother, they had some knowledge of things, but they kept it hush. I mean, they swore an oath of silence in 1921 that we're changing our name to Miller, and we're Miller, and we're not going to tell this to our children or grandchildren. And my grandfather took it to his grave.
Wow.
So it took a lot of research to figure out why, you know, scouring these newspaper articles, scouring the court documents of the case, looking at old letters that were written, and just finding the property. We even went to St. Mary's Cemetery trying to find George Pohalski's gravesite, my great-grandfather. We knew it was in St. Mary's Cemetery in Warren, Ohio, but we didn't know exactly where. So
any sign of him?
The records were kept in St. Mary's Catholic Church, and we found him in the records there, but we could not locate the gravesite.
Yeah.
We don't know if it's an unmarked grave or if the sandstone's been worn since 1920.
Sure.
So that was one thing we weren't able to do. We just didn't know exactly where he was.
Well, it sounds like an amazing book. It is Heart of Steel. It's by my guest, Kevin Miller. And Kevin, congratulations on doing that. I would imagine you haven't written books before.
No, my professional job is a web developer. I'm also a technical writer, so I am used to writing, but writing a novel is, it doesn't always translate. Writing a novel is a whole different
thing. It's a whole different animal. But congratulations on trying something out of your comfort zone to make sure that story lives on for generations. And boy, you've gone through it all. Court records, oral tradition, digitized newspapers, and you've really uncovered some amazing secrets. Congratulations. Of course, the book is available through Amazon.com, or you can go to HeartOfSteelBook.com as well. Thanks so much for your time, Kevin.
Thank you, Fisher. I appreciate it.